Hello and welcome to our genetic markers related to digestion presentation. I'm Dr. Rita Merlo-Scalzo, and I'm excited to be able to present this because this is a very cutting edge topic. 25 years ago when I first got into practice, there was no way that we could look at people's genetics, let alone know which genetic markers had some relationship to the digestion. The genomics project first started back in the mid-1990s, I believe, and over those last 2.5 decades, we've been learning more and more and more about some of these genetic markers and what they mean and how some of them are related to certain functions in different parts of the body, including digestion, hormones, etc. So I'm going to present to you what is today cutting edge information, which in 6 months will be old stuff and there'll be probably lots of new stuff. This is a very growing field and it's really fun to be on the forefront. That said, it's really important to recognize that anything that we talk about should not be construed as medical information. And whenever you're presenting genetic type things to your clients, it should never be presented as medical, as fact. It's usually intended as education so that they kind of get a sense of where their genetics may lie and what areas of their body they may be having some issues with in terms of tendencies or predispositions towards certain conditions. And that said, we're going to talk a lot tonight about epigenetics and the importance of epigenetic modification via diet and lifestyle, which is what we're all really good at helping people to incorporate. So anything I say, if you're looking at it for your own genetics or your client's genetics, make sure that you realize that it's not medical advice. There's no warranties of any kind regarding specific benefits, etc. So please keep that in mind. So let's just start with the hole in the system, which is disease management. We're not really excited, us in this more holistic functional medicine realm, about disease management. Disease management is not really helping to get to the root cause and helping people to truly get well. It's usually just applying different colored band-aids and throwing a dart in the dark and hoping that it lands in the right place and that we've made the proper quote-unquote diagnosis so that the proper treatment can be applied. What we're really about is true healthcare, getting to the root cause and helping people to correct the underlying imbalances that are causing what's presenting with them. Some of these are lifestyle interventions. Some of these are specific areas where their genetics need to have much more pristine lifestyle than maybe someone with different genetics would. So what I'm going to try to do is tie together some of the genetics related to the digestive tract and how you can use these things to help you, almost like it's like ammunition with your clients to help them to actually do the things that you might have recommended anyway, but also to steer you in directions of specific nutrients that they may need more of because of some of these genetic imbalances or tendencies and whatnot. So it can really help you in putting together balancing protocols for people. And before we do, I really want to get into a little bit of the general, just cut so we're all on the same page in looking at this, looking at genetic testing, nutrigenomics, and then wrapping it all into a package with digestion. Very important that we see the big picture, because if I just jump in and start talking about SNPs and you don't know what a SNP is, and I say, well, this SNP at this gene, and you're like, okay, I'm really gone. Now, a lot of people have heard this term, single nucleotide polymorphisms, and really what they are is variations in the gene expression. So we basically, the genes are made up of nucleotides, and there's 3 billion different base pairs. And a single base pair, now a base pair meaning one portion of a gene from a mom and one portion from the dad, they come together and they should be identical for most things, not necessarily all things, but they should be the same. So an area where that may be different is like eyes. Eye color is controlled by single nucleotide polymorphism, SNPs. You may get one gene from dad and one gene from mom, and the whatever happens on the result for you has to do with dominance and recessiveness and all that Darwinian stuff that we learned in high school. But polymorphisms are really variations in that genetic code. So a single base pair can get added, deleted, or substituted. So there's 10 million SNPs that have been identified so far in the genome. And most of these lead to no observable differences, okay? Like 90-some percent, 99%, 98%, something like that. There's nothing that we have learned so far about them. But many are normal variations, like I said, blue eyes, brown eyes, things like that. But still others have been found to be correlated with specific diseases or nutrient imbalances. And those are the ones that we're interested in. And we're going to talk a little bit as we go on about some testing processes. And the testing usually can test up to several hundred thousand of these 10 million ones. And some of them are more clinically relevant than others. So it can be confusing when you see a genetics report. So let's just talk about what nutrigenomics is. It's the study of the effect of food and food constituents on the expression of genes, the influence of genetic variations on nutrition. So if somebody has a specific genetic variation that affects the absorption of certain kinds of fats or certain nutrients, that's going to affect that person's nutrient balance. And there may be certain foods that will trigger the expression of certain genes that maybe not be beneficial for someone, or may be beneficial if the food constituents are things that are on the positive end. It's also the correlation between the single nucleotide polymorphisms, and you'll hear me call them SNPs. It's much easier to say SNP than single nucleotide polymorphism, and the nutrients absorption, metabolism, elimination, or biological effects. And we're going to look at some of those pathways that are affected by these specific SNPs and how these SNPs may increase your client's need for a certain nutrient, may predispose them towards conditions like celiac disease or Crohn's disease or other autoimmune disease, and may in other ways affect the biological pathways, the metabolic pathways. Nutrigenomics also provides us with a rational way to optimize people's nutrition with respect to their genes. So we no longer say to people, oh, you're that, it's your genes. You have rheumatoid arthritis because your mom had it and your grandmother had it. Therefore, you have it because it's your genes and there's nothing you can do about it. The beauty of this whole process is that about, this is the estimate, 95% of the conditions of the manifestations of these pathways are controlled by the environment, the diet, the lifestyle, the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the other 5% by the genes. And we'll look at epigenetic expression, and that's the piece where we can shine with people, where we can really be the heroes with people by helping them to see which habits they need to kick and which habits they need to take on in order to have the best effects from the genetics they've been given. So epigenetics is kind of like a layer over the genes. And these modifications, they don't affect the DNA sequences themselves, but they affect the way the genes are expressed. They can turn off or on the expression. And I want to give you an example. And this may seem like an odd example, but every cell in the body has the genetics for every cell in the body, right? Every single one. So why don't we have eyeballs growing out of our belly button, right? Why? Well, it has to do with epigenetics. Certain of those markers that, whoops, this is a belly button. We do not turn on the eyeball genes. Clunk. So everything except belly button is turned on in the belly button. Got it? So this happens throughout the body. Well, the same thing can happen with genes that can predispose towards conditions like Alzheimer's or heart disease. Yeah, you might have a gene that puts you at a higher risk for heart disease. But if your lifestyle and diet and nutrients are set up in such a way that it's favorable, then you can keep that gene from expressing itself. But if you're in a stressful environment, poor nutrition, lots of toxicity, then that gene can be turned on. That's the epigenetic modification of the expression of the genes. Stem cells, which are the infant cells where all the cells come from, they get their organ-specific functions turned on and off through this epigenetic process. It's basically what I just told you about the belly button not having an eyeball growing out of it. Got it? So a change in gene expression can result from a lot of things, from environmental factors that once they go beyond the tipping point, like maybe your constitution is such that you can tolerate maybe exposure to cigarette smoke secondhand 3 times a year, and it doesn't really hurt anything. But once you go beyond that, once you do like I did, which was live in an environment where there was cigarette smoke there all the waking hours, then that can turn on certain genes that I might not otherwise have had, which then, in my humble opinion, led to my health decline when I was in my 20s. That plus the Kool-Aid and the M&Ms and the Pringles and all the other stuff, the lack of nutrition in the environment. Okay, so we can modify, we can help our clients to see, not to take these reports as a life sentence. Oh, well, I got the Alzheimer's gene, I'm going to get Alzheimer's. But oh my goodness, I better really research on what it is that I can do to support my body in the process so that gene doesn't express itself. Okay, so diet and lifestyle influence the epigenetics more than anything else. So let's just look at this little chart, and this may look a little complicated or confusing, but it's really just showing us the effects of environment on the genes. So across the top, we have some environmental factors that can affect the epigenome. So diet, toxins, drugs, inflammation, hypoxia, which is, you know, lack of good oxygen, mother's care and early life experience, right? Were you abandoned? Were you abused? Were you in a household where there was abuse and lots of fighting? That makes a huge difference. The aging process does contribute to the epigenetic stress because it's just years of accumulation of these other environmental stressors. And then, of course, chemicals and radiation. What that does is cause an epigenetic modulation. It has to do with effects on the DNA methylation histone. So methylation is a key factor in epigenetic expression. And we'll talk a little bit more about methylation in a bit before we get into the specifics genes that are associated with digestion. And then that affects the genomic DNA. It has to do with the stability of the gene. How fragile is that gene and the expression, which then can cause the development of epigenetic pathologies and disease if those factors, those lifestyle factors, get to be too heavy. And that can cause the initiation, the progression, and the remodeling of those genes. And that creates a change, which we see as somebody coming in and complaining about an autoimmune disease, a thyroid condition, adrenal burnout, Crohn's disease, IBS, and some of those other things that we do meet people in our practices who are suffering from. Mental illnesses as well are affected. So what's methylation? You've probably heard this over and over again. You can't be around the internet or around any kind of publications related to health without hearing about methylation. Methylation is the process of creating these special tags called methyl groups, and we'll look at what those look like in a minute, to affect how the gene expresses itself. Methylation is either the maintenance or change to DNA by adding, removing, or deleting methyl groups, or modifying methyl groups. Usually they silence gene expression. Okay? So methylation is a process for taking this group, this basically methyl group, which is a CH2, carbon, hydrogen, CH3, carbon and three hydrogens, and popping that onto a molecule. And it completely changes that molecule and makes it a methyl donor, which then affects the DNA. There's a cycle called the SAMe, S-adenosylmethionine/methionine cycle, which is the conversion from homocysteine to methionine to SAMe. That's also known as the methylation cycle because it can affect DNA methylation, and it's the major generator of the methyl groups that are used in DNA repair and also blood cell creation, red blood cell. So there it is, the hot potato, the methyl group, and it's basically passed around. If you ever played a game of hot potato, and you take the potato and it goes and it doesn't stay anywhere very long, it just hangs. Most of the time, that's what happens with the methyl group. It just gets passed around and passed around and passed around until it gets to the DNA and then does its thing. Some of the chemicals in the body that you may have heard of, I'm sure you've heard of most of these, are called methyl donors because they're ones that can pass the potato around. SAMe, folate, which is vitamin B9, vitamin B12, cobalamin, and there's several forms of cobalamin. Methylcobalamin means a cobalamin that has this methyl donor attached to it. And then TMG, trimethylglycine, DMG, dimethylglycine, and DMAE, dimethylaminoethanolamine. So that's it. And when you hear about people talking MTHFR, MTHFR is related to folate. It's a methyl donor. It's a folate, form of folate that has the methyl group attached to it. And the MTHFR is a SNP, a variation in the gene that methylates the folate. And it's a critical hub, a critical point in that methylation cycle for taking that hot potato methyl group and passing it all around till it eventually gets to SAMe, which does the work. Okay, so it's really important to understand this before we can jump right into the stuff that's related to digestion. So methylation functions are to turn genes on and off and to synthesize DNA, to process toxins. So there are certain liver phase two processes that require methylation in order to detoxify some of the heavy metals and some of the hormones, etc. Build and metabolize neurotransmitters. So this is really important, because it's important for building the neurotransmitters, epinephrine, norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, and melatonin. Melatonin is not really a neurotransmitter, but it's in that group. But it also is important for metabolizing. So once those are used up for getting rid of and excreting the byproducts. And so what happens when we have certain pathways that are blocked because of epigenetic modification of the genetic SNP there that this person is expressing, then what we see is that we get buildup of things like metabolized dopamine, which keeps a person in an excitatory state. So a lot of people who are experiencing anxiety can be doing so because of some of these methylation problems in their genes. So processes, hormones, estrogen in particular, build immune cells, so for T cells and NK cells, natural killer cells. It also helps to produce energy in the mitochondria. Methylation is super important. CoQ10, carnitine, creatinine, and ATP. It helps to produce myelin sheaths. So we see that people with methylation issues and specific lifestyle environments can create things like MS, multiple sclerosis, because of the destruction of the myelin sheaths. And then building and maintaining cell membranes, because it's important in the creation of phosphatidylcholine, which is an important phospholipid in the cell membrane, which is really important, especially in digestion, right? Because that membrane, that an endothelial lining of the small intestine, is so important for bringing the nutrients from the food and into the body. So let's look a little bit at some testing, and then we'll jump in to the specific SNPs that are related to digestion. So let's see. I'm sure many of you have heard of 23andMe. They're advertised all over the place. Almost everybody has heard of 23andMe, even people not in the medical realm. I have people saying, did you ever hear of 23andMe? I'm thinking about getting that test done. So 23andMe basically takes a swab of cheek, or it's actually saliva, actually. Some of them do swabs of your cheek. But it's a saliva sample. And from that, they are able to analyze your genome. They can take and analyze, I think, up to several 300,000 different SNPs on those genes. And for some, there's some really good research. And for others, there aren't. When 23andMe first came out to do this, they were offering their tests for $399. And I got one. It was many years ago, probably 8 years ago I did it. I had had it run on my husband. I'm always running these new tests to see how they work, so my family members get the brunt of it. So ran one of those tests on my husband. It was $400. And we got to see some stuff, but I didn't know anything about reading the raw data at that point. So I just looked at what they said. Oh, he has a higher risk of this and a higher risk of that. So they had this whole health data that they would give you as a result of the testing. They also gave you ancestry stuff. So you would look at the ancestry and say, oh, you're how much Neanderthal, or my relatives are from South Africa or wherever. But they gave their own interpretation. Well, they got shut down by the FDA for doing that about 3 years ago because the FDA felt like they weren't there wasn't enough research to really give that information and to tell somebody, hey, you've got this ApoE gene that's a 4-4 and you have a high risk of cardiac disease and Alzheimer's, or you have this BRCA gene, that nobody really knew what to do with that information. So the FDA made them verify and do a whole lot of stuff to their database. And they shut down the whole health thing. And people said, oh, you can't go 23andMe anymore. Well, that's not true. You could still access what's called the raw data. And I'm going to show you what that is and how to get that so that then we can move into how do you look for the specific SNPs related to digestion. So when they came back just a few months ago, I think they came back with the reports, FDA approved. I haven't really gone through them to see how much different they are, but what they did was they raised the price to $199 if you wanted the health reports, but if you just wanted the ancestry reports, they would only charge you $99. And when I show you some of the screenshots a little bit later, I'm going to show you how you can still get all that you want for the $99 because it's all in the raw data and their report doesn't mean anything. So Pathway Fit is another one. They've been around for a while. I ran that on a couple of people as well. They just basically take some of the popular ones and they make a really pretty report. So it's kind of nice, but to me, it wasn't as clinically useful as some of these others. Yeah, they had some really cool stuff that said, oh, this person, you know, doesn't tolerate carbohydrates, or this person has a sweet tooth, or this person doesn't tolerate bitter taste. And there's some good stuff in there related to vitamin A and E and all that stuff. But the report wasn't as complete as I would have liked it to be. Plus, it wasn't as clinically relevant. I like to know, well, does this person have an MTHFR6677T? Is it heterozygous, homozygous? And I'll show you what that means in a bit. Or do they have, you know, FUT2, which is related to digestion? Do they have as things related to gluten? And they didn't have all that in a clinically relevant way. But still, it's a valid test if people want to get it done. The one I first did was Holistic Health International, which was Dr. Amy Yasko's test. And I think they still do it at holistichealth.com. A very limited subset of the genome is done. And it's specifically the methylation stuff related to autism, because that's what Dr. Yasko specializes in. So she identified the genes that were related to kids that were autistic, and she runs a test like that. I think when I ran that one, that was about $400 as well. Genova Diagnostics, they've probably been testing genes longer than anyone. They first started coming out and they would do little packets of individual genes. So you might be able to get a cardiac panel, a liver panel, and that's stuff. They have about six of those. If you were to add up all of those panels, it still wouldn't give you all the information that you get from the 23andMe test. And it would cost you $2,000 to $3,000 because each of those panels is $300 to $400. And then finally, you can run MTHFR alone at SpectraCell, and it runs about $200 to do that. So in general, most practitioners are recommending the 23andMe and then running the raw data through some of the different filters that are currently available. And I'm going to show you what the main ones that I like are. So this is what the site looks like if you go to 23andMe.com. If you go to 23andMe.com/DrLascalzo, and there's another link that we can give you if you're in Canada or the UK. You can actually get $20 off. They think they still honor that that discount. So I signed up to be their affiliate, but instead of, you know, sending you to the main thing with my affiliate code and getting $20 for everybody that runs it, I decided I would just make it easier for everybody to do it because I wanted everybody in my programs to do it. So that's the way it's been. I've been doing that for a couple of years. When you go there, their site looks very different than it used to. I went there to put this presentation together and it was very different, so I had to change my slides a lot. So you just basically get to order the ancestry or the health, and then once you do, you can click on a page down, a link down below that to compare them. And this is hard to read. It's probably easier in your slides and you'll see it when you go to their site. But I just wanted to point out that the difference is you get the ancestry report on both, but you don't get all the health reports on the ancestry. But look, the raw data, you get the raw data for both. And I'm going to show you what the raw data means and why that's what you really want. So if you don't care about 23andMe's interpretation on the health side, then I would say just spend the $99. But if you do care and you think it would be valuable for your clients, then get them to do that one. I would first run it on yourself, run the full one, and see how valuable you think that is. It might be actually very valuable when you're first starting out doing the interpretations. So then once you're in the site, you log in. This is my account. I logged in as me. There's this little thing up here that says tools. That's what you click on to get to access your raw data. When you click there, you're going to get to this page that shows you the various tools. I haven't really looked at all the rest of this yet because it's new, but the raw data is what I looked at. So when you click on raw data, that's the actual file. If you were to download it, it's like a 15 megabyte file that has all the SNPs. But I'm going to show you what it looks like. So it's not real friendly unless you're a geneticist and have been studying this and have created your own databases. This is what they ask you to do before they actually show it to you. They say raw data opt-in. The data belongs to, you know, you have to just say, okay, I agree. So you're basically telling you some disclaimer stuff. And this is what it looks like when you get into the raw data. So it shows you, you can either search by a specific SNP or a specific what's called RSID. The RSID is what is identified one of these related to each one. So specific ID, and that's what's in PubMed and all the other places where they're doing their research. And then the name of the gene is also searchable. So you, in this box, you'd put that. Right now, all I did was I clicked on gene 5. Now, personally, I don't know which gene these various things fall on. Maybe I should spend some time studying that or at least make myself a list as to which gene FUT2 falls on or HLA, you know, DQ2 or whatever, or MTHFR, but I don't. So what I did was I just did this just to show you when you click the gene itself, any of these genes, it's going to give you a list that looks like mumbo jumbo. The first one is the gene itself, and the first few on each of the genes are what's called intergenic, and those are basically pieces of the DNA that are between genes, so they don't really have a name. They all have RSIDs associated with them and positions, and they've all identified which of the nucleotides you're going to see there. It's either going to be an A or a G. And without spending an hour going into all the bases and all that, I just want to say that generally speaking, when we're looking at the ones that are clinically relevant, one of those numbers is going to be what's called the risk allele, and one of them is going to be what's called the wild type. So if you see those terms used in genetic research, you'll know what it means. The wild type happens to be the quote-unquote normal. So on some of the reports, we'll see in a bit, that's green. Green and green. You got the same gene, like say it was an A and an A from mom and dad, and it's considered the wild type or the one that doesn't have any kind of problems associated with it. The other one is called the risk allele, meaning that if you have one or both of those variants, then you're at higher risk for decreased function of the enzyme that that codes for, decreased function in general. And then your genotype is at the end. Some of them say cannot be determined, but most of them will have what you have. So in this case, it might have an AA, a GG, et cetera. But because these are intergenetic and they really haven't done much with identifying and they may not even have a purpose, they're just listed that way. So then this one is where I put in MTHFR up at the top, and it shows me all that. So it looks like MTHFR is on the first gene. See how it's pink? And I didn't do that. I just put in MTHFR up here. But now it's listing, again, a whole bunch of gobbledygook because it's listing, and it goes on and on and on. There's a lot of different variations and parts of the gene that are related to MTHFR. And so when we look at it, there's all those RSIDs. So in order for this data in the raw data to be useful, you need to do a lot of work to look up the individual RSIDs. So I wanted to show you MTHFR C677T is the one that's most associated with disorders and imbalances in the body. It's the most clinically relevant. So I went to the web and I looked up MTHFR C677T, and I got to this SNPedia database to find out that the RSID was 80113. Sorry, I cut off the far end. All right, so this shows me that this is the MTHFR C677T, and this is the RSID. So then I went back to into our 23andMe raw data, and I just put RS1801133 up at the top, and sure enough, it shows me this MTHFR. See, it still doesn't say anything about C677T. It also doesn't say anything about which is the good one and which is the imbalanced one. If I look this up on my handy dandy cheat sheet, which we have in our NEPT program, our nutrigenomics module, C677T, the normal, what we want is G, GG. So see here it says the variables are A or G, and my genotype is AG. So I got an A from one parent and a G from the other. That means that I'm heterozygous for this MTHFR SNP. And what that really means in this particular case is that there's like a 30% decrease in the function of that enzyme because I have an heterozygous SNP. But see, I don't know when I see that. It's A or C. I know that one's right and one's wrong, but I don't know which it's supposed to be. But it's supposed to be G. Let me just look and make sure this is risk allele or normal is G. So in this case, but that's why there's a problem in doing the interpretation straight from the raw data, is because you'd have to look up each of these things and try to find out for yourself, well, which one is right, which one is wrong. Because if somebody had a GG, you wouldn't know if they were homozygous for that SNP, meaning they got both bad genes and they have an 80% decrease in that gene's function if it's expressed, or if they had AA, which means that they're normal, right? So that's the limitations of using the straight raw data, which is why we use a variety of tools to interpret that data, right? You don't have the time, unless you're a geneticist researcher, to sit and do all this research to figure out which ones are associated and what they really mean. So we use some of these reports. Geneticgenie.org. Theirs is free, but they ask you for like a $5 donation for it. And they basically run two different reports, a detox one and a methylation one. MTHFR support is $35, I think, or $30. And they generate you a report that's like 49 pages of SNPs, and they are basically listed like one after another in a chart that shows whether they are green, which means that you got both good genes from both parents, yellow, which is one from one parent, one from the other, that's not the way it's supposed to be, or red, which is the wrong way. So they give you a nice report, and they have some graphs and beautiful diagrams on the report, as well as some of the genes you can click and get more detailed information. Some of them you can't. Okay, so that's a nice report, and I do usually run that on everybody just because I like having the completeness of it. I can look up everything that I want. Most things are going to be found on there, most things that are clinically relevant. So we go into some other things which have really nice interpretations, some nicer than others. My favorite of the ones, the reports that give you a nice description, is the Metabolic Healing, metabolichealing.com. And basically what that does is it has pages of different areas of the body. So here's the genes that are related to cardiac function. Here's the ones that are related to digestive function, brain function, etc. And you can go through that report and actually make sense of it if you want to explain it to one of your clients. Is it complete? No. Is it clinically relevant? Yes. So definitely we can go overboard and want too many genes and want to understand too many, and then get ourselves overwhelmed and not be so useful anymore. So the Metabolic Healing, I think it's my favorite of the reports. If I had to do just, since Genetic Genie is free, I usually run that, MTHFR support and Metabolic Healing. But if I had to just run one, I'd probably run the Metabolic Healing. Stratagene is one from Ben Lynch at seekinghealth.org. And it, like the Metabolic Healing one, it's got some good stuff to it. It's also has some really pretty charts, so you can see on the diagrams where it is, right? And so it's got this usefulness that the others don't have in terms of that. But in terms of the descriptions and the way it's laid out and the completeness, it's not quite as descriptive and easy for the end user to understand until they're pretty far along in their research. Livewello and Prometheus, I haven't used very much. Prometheus gives you this big database of stuff that you can search, and they have some nice descriptions. Personally, I found them cumbersome, so I don't use them very often, but I wanted to give you that so you can at least check it out. My recommendation is, if you want to really learn this stuff, is to run this on yourself or a family member, but you know, it's nice to run it on yourself and run all these reports and compare it for a single person, and then just see which ones you find the most useful, and study and study and study. And we have a lot of that. We do a lot of that in NEPT. So the SNPs related to digestion. So I made a list. And at first, when I started making this list, I started put in all the RSIDs, which meant a lot of looking up and a lot of research. And after I spent an hour and only got through about five or six of them, I decided that I wasn't going to be that kind with my time, that I would actually make it a learning tool for you guys to be able to look at. So here's some of these things, and some of them are directly related to digestion, and some of them are related to things that are related to digestion. So I'm going to share with you, I'll give you some brief explanations of a lot of these. I'll go into more depth on some others, and then I'm going to go into even more depth with one in particular, which is one of the ones that affect digestion so much that we really need to be aware of it, which is FUT2. Okay, so you'll have this. There's three pages like this, and then there's some more information on the digestive ones that are from the Metabolic Healing Report. So MC4R regulates energy balance. Well, energy balance is important for every system in the body because we have to have enough cellular energy for that organ system or glandular system to do its job. So what I recommend you do with these charts is to print them out and keep them handy. And when you're running reports, you can check some of these to see how they play up on some of your clients. COMT, catecholamine O-methyltransferase, can cause IBS because it's responsible for the metabolism of dopamine. And if it's not running properly, you can get a buildup of dopamine metabolites, which can cause anxiety and IBS type symptoms. CYP27B1 codes an enzyme that activates vitamin D. Okay, so vitamin D, you know, we get it generated from sun exposure or taken orally. It has to go through the kidney and liver to get activated. And the CYP has to do with activation of D. D is critically important for digestive function, as we know, because it is important for the integrity of the membrane, so the blood-brain barrier and the endothelial membrane. DHCR7 is related to cholesterol and vitamin D synthesis. So again, very important in the integrity of the membranes. MTHFR, we've mentioned that before. It's related to folate metabolism. So it methylates folate, which ends up sending that methyl group around and feeding it into CME, which is important for what? DNA repair. So MTHFR definitely has an important role in gut repair and methylation and detoxification. HLA-DQ2 is related to celiac disease and gluten sensitivity risk. It's the most common gene that 90% of all celiac patients have it. So if somebody has a HLA-DQ2, most likely they have a celiac, a true full-blown celiac. Okay, HLA-DQ8 increases the risk of celiac. It's less prevalent than DQ2, but it's in celiacs, but it's also related to non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So these are critical for the integrity of the gut membrane. ATG16L1 increases the risk of Crohn's disease and IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, because it's involved in the degradation of cells, so the damage to the cells. APOA4 has a role in lipid absorption in the intestines. So it's affecting that transport of the fats through the endothelial membrane. And here's my favorite one to talk about related to digestion, which is FUT2. What that does, it's really an interesting mechanism. It impacts the ability of the cells to secrete ABO, our blood type antigens, into the blood fluids like saliva, sweat, tears, and the gut. People who are non-secretors make more bifidobacter, so the bifidus probiotic, bifidus, as they can't make oligosaccharides, which are short-chain polysaccharides, short-chain carbohydrates, that feed them. So that resistant starch and that those short-chain fats and the saccharides that the bifidobacter grow on are not complete. Their diet is not complete, so they don't grow very well. But on the positive side, the non-secretors are more resistant to H. pylori and rotavirus and have a higher, but they also have a higher incidence of Crohn's and B12 deficiency. So that's a really important one, and we're going to go into a little bit more detail on that after I finish showing you all of these. DAO is diamine oxidase, is responsible for the breakdown of histamine. And histamines are really important in terms of digestive process, because if we can't break down the histamines that are contained in the food, then we have a histamine type reaction. So when your clients say, every time I eat certain foods, I just get red, or my skin breaks out, or whatever, it may be an allergy, but it also may be a histamine intolerance. DAO is one of the genes that code there. ACE regulates fluid balance and blood pressure. And so the fluid balance is regulated by the absorption of fluids in the intestine, as well as the retention of the fluids in the electrolytes by the kidneys. GIF, also called TCN3, is involved in the formation of intrinsic factor, which is made by the parietal cells of the stomach and latches itself onto B12 so that B12 can then be absorbed in the distal ileum. So this affects how much B12 the system has. And it's almost like this vicious cycle, because with lack of B12, there's less methyl donors, which affects the repair. So it's this vicious cycle of stuff. And as I'm explaining these to you, you might be thinking, so if a person has this particular, like say somebody has an FUT2 and they have a GIF, they're going to definitely need more B12. And there's some other things that are related to B12 as well. So PEMT, phosphoethanolamine methyltransferase, is involved in the conversion of the phospholipid ethanolamine into phosphatidylcholine. And phosphatidylcholine is a very important phospholipid in cell membranes in all parts of the body, the brain and the liver, but especially in the intestine, and that's how it's related to digestion. So that's just the first group of them. I'm going to go through. Now, again, I want you to have heard these, and I want you to have these charts that you can look at and you can refer to when you get genetic testing done. But it also helps you to see, like, there's a lot of ways that somebody's genetics can make them more susceptible to problems, which is why some people you hear of have the ironclad stomach. You know, they can eat anything and they never get an upset stomach and everything seems to be fine. And other people seem to be much more sensitive. A lot of these genes play into that, right? So it's not a matter of, this person has enough B12 in their diet, we don't need to give them more. Well, if they have this gene and they've got some damage to their parietal cells in the stomach, they're not going to make enough intrinsic factor for the B12 to be absorbed, and they are going to need some supplementation. So while there's not a this for that, like this gene, you should have this supplement, it's a matter of keeping these things in mind to help you to create balancing protocols for your clients. So part two, let's look at a few more of these. SHMT, serine hydromethyltransferase. It's involved in purine synthesis via folate derivatives. Well, what are they? Well, that has to do with DNA. Mutations can involve abnormal iron metabolism and a predisposition to GI pathogens. So SHMT, it's very often associated with leaky gut. So ANKK1, also called DRD2, affects the amount of effort you put out to obtain food. Like some people, I'm hungry, who cares, right? And others, I'm starving, right? That can have to do with this gene. Then there's some of the taste genes, TAS2R38, which is related to bitter taster, and TAS1R3, which is a sweet tooth gene. Now, if you have someone who tastes the bitterness, like finds it unpleasant, they have the TAS2R38 gene expressing and the TAS1R3 sweet tooth gene, it's going to be really hard to get them to sit down and eat kale because they taste it, or arugula. So you've got to be able to help those people with like a salad dressing that has some sweetness, but you don't want it to be sugar because sugar is going to feed bad gut bugs. So you're going to be using more of, say, stevia or lohan, or I don't know what else, tomatoes or red bell peppers, so that they taste the sweet and it overcompensates for the bitter. It really helps you in putting together food plans for people. FTO is related to not feeling satiated after eating. You ever have those people who is like, I'm just still hungry, I ate and I ate and I ate? Well, yeah, that could be related to their blood sugar being out of balance, but it can also be related to not feeling satiated. To this not feeling satiated could be related to this gene. LEPR is related to leptin. And we know that leptin is a gene that tells the cells, hey, got enough. It's secreted by the fat cells and says, hey, we've had enough. Let's turn off the appetite. If that receptor is genetically altered, then the person's not going to get that, and they're going to snack. They're going to really feel the need to snack all the time. Another one related to sweet tooth is SLC2A2. And then there's some related to specific nutrients. So SLC23A1 is a risk of decreased vitamin C and increased risk of gastric cancer and inflammatory bowel disease, right? So when you get some of these in combination with each other, you can really have a clear picture of why people might be feeling and acting the way they do. All right, more. MAOA catalyzes the deamination of dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, and it's associated with a variety of psychiatric disorders, including antisocial, obsessive compulsives, and anxiety. So why do I put that in there? Well, because the gut and the brain are intimately connected. And when someone's in this state where they have too much or not enough dopamine or serotonin, it affects the bowels, because serotonin and dopamine, actually there's more of them in the bowels than there are in the brain. And so with serotonin, we actually, or dopamine, excess dopamine and serotonin, we actually can get irritable bowel. It causes an increase in the gut motility. GAD is involved in the conversion of glutamate to GABA. Again, GABA is found in the gut and it's a calmer. So in someone who has irritable bowel, then you might be looking at a problem with the glutamate to GABA conversion. And in that person, you maybe want to be careful about giving glutamine, because glutamine can convert to glutamate, which can get stuck and get built up instead of being converted to GABA. Glutamate is excitatory, okay? So it causes irritation. LRRK2 is linked to increased risk of Parkinson's. And I found some recent research over the last year that links Parkinson's to symptoms of constipation. And so you may like, what, Parkinson's? Well, they were saying that constipation may be an early sign of Parkinson's, because it's a spasmodic condition of the gut. So this can be related to gut. And it's really important to, when somebody has constipation and it's not the obvious, like, you know, eating too much fat and not enough fiber, or, you know, not drinking enough water, not moving enough, then you start to think, well, what are some of the zebras in that case, right? When we think, hear horse beats, we think horses, not zebras. But when we've exhausted the possibilities of the horses, we start to look at zebras. And so Parkinson's is one of the zebras that you might want to look at in terms of chronic constipation that's not responding. Also, constipation that maybe came on, that they didn't have it their whole life, it came on as they got older, that could be more of an indication that it might be related to Parkinson's. IgA is an immune protection. IgA is immunoglobulin A, and it's related to mucous membrane protection. So that's important for the GI and other mucous membranes. And the TAS2R38 is related to eating disinhibition. So the person is prompted to eat more. There's still more. So part three. CYP2E1 is related to alcohol metabolism and effects on liver and pancreas. So how the alcohol is metabolized and how it affects the liver and the pancreas. So you see somebody with a CYP2E1, homozygous, you're going to really warn them about alcohol consumption and the effects it could be having on their gut, to say nothing of feeding yeast and all that kind of stuff. APOA2 regulates after-meal response to saturated fat. Okay, so in the C variant of APOA2, saturated fats basically create a situation where fat is stored. The T variation won't. So we're looking at that to see, well, why does this person gain weight on when they eat fat? Like, put somebody on coconut and a lot of people lose weight, and some people gain weight. Could be related to this gene. The GSTM3 V224I is associated with late onset Alzheimer's disease. And why do we put Alzheimer's in here? Again, it's the gut-brain connection, the connection between Alzheimer's and insulin resistance and sugar dysregulation. And a lot of that happens, a lot of the signaling related to sugars in the food happen in the gut via a series of gut hormones, as you learned in our gut hormone module. ApoE associated with Alzheimer's disease and the ability to process saturated fat. So some people can take on lots of saturated fat and not develop heart disease or Alzheimer's. But there's a lot of research that says, well, saturated fat causes heart disease. Well, that's not true as a general statement. In some people, yes, it does. And it's the people with the ApoE4/4 variant that are the most sensitive, and the ApoE3/4 variant that are next most sensitive. So those people have to have a really low fat diet in general, but mostly the saturated fat and the animal fat is the culprit there. So CYP2C19 increases the risk of GERD, reflux disease. CCL26 increases the risk of reflux and also eosinophilic esophagitis. So reflux gets up into the esophagus, starts tearing and burning it away. And I have a funny story about eosinophilic esophagitis. My son once in school was like, "Mom, I think my friend has eosinophilic esophagitis." And I'm like, "What? What do you know about that?" Well, I started looking up his symptoms, and that's what it looks like. A lot of it's related to alcohol consumption and the effect of alcohol on the delicate esophageal tissue. ADRB3. There's a possible link there to risk of gallstones and gallbladder cancer. So it's all part of the digestive tract, right? We can't process fats very well without our gallbladder. So PPARGC1A is associated with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. MCM6 is associated with lactose intolerance. So there are actually some people who are more likely to not tolerate milk sugar lactose and others less likely. MCM6 is the gene. So GC encodes an enzyme that transports the vitamin D in the blood into the cells. So it causes a risk of decreased vitamin D, which affects the composition of the bacterial flora and also the gut wall. VDR is a vitamin D receptor. So we're really looking at vitamin D as very important here, and VDR is a receptor. It's also associated with some other things, including relationship with MAO. FADS1 is the risk of decreased omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. So that's an important one because without the right omega-3s, inflammation abounds, right? So people with inflammatory bowels, people with leaky gut, and other sorts of inflammation, pancreatitis, cholecystitis, anything with the itises related to the gut, it's really important that they have their omega-3-6. So if they have this, they're going to have to be more careful about their omega-3-6 ratios. And then finally, IRF5, interferon regulatory factor, is involved in the formation of antiviral cytokine, interferon. It might be involved in switching macrophages to increase or decrease the interferon productions. And we see mutations in IRFS in things like IBS and scleroderma, which is a condition of the connective tissue, the skin type tissue. So there we have it for the SNPs that I've found to be related to digestion. Is this 100% complete? Probably not, right? Because it's constantly new information abounding. But is it a good starting point for you and give you some good ideas for looking at things related for your clients? Absolutely, when you get their reports. So I wanted to give you an example of the report from Metabolic Healing, which has a really nice setup where they have the separate different categories. So under the GI health genetics, they give you a list. And this is a common way to present genetic information, where you have the RSID, you've got the gene itself, you've got, this one shows you the call, which is what that person had, and they also give you the risk allele. So in this particular case, this first FUT2, the risk allele is G, and, G? Yeah, that's G, and what we have is GG, okay? So in this particular case, this is my genes. So my FUT2 status is not so hot, right? Three genes, three homozygouses. So what this means for me is that I have an increased risk of vitamin B12 deficiency. I have an increased risk of gut flora dysbiosis and an overgrowth of bad flora because I don't feed my bifidus. So what does this mean? It means I need to be making sure that my diet is replete with tons of probiotic food. So When I saw this, I laughed because I realized how connected that was to my cravings for food. I love fermented foods. I don't just sit down and eat a couple of forkfuls of sauerkraut or fermented vegetables or kimchi. I eat the whole jar. I don't just sit down if I make cashew yogurt or coconut yogurt. I don't just sit down and eat a couple of spoonfuls. I just want a huge portion. I love that taste. Kevita, kombucha, all those kinds of things. My body craves that probably because I have this FUT2 gene variation. And, you know, early on I was fed cow's milk formula, you know, the really bad formula stuff. I was fed the standard American diet, lots and lots of sugar, no probiotic foods, no vegetables to speak of. So my early environment plus my genetics have led me to be aware that I need to be doing a lot of probiotic supplementation. So this next one, GIF, we'll look at these below, but I thought I'd tell you more about this one, phospholipid related, leaky gut related. Okay, so we went through these in that other chart. So I'm going to show you what their description is so you get a little bit more in depth on it. So on here, they give you the various RSIDs of the particular FUT2. And what you'll see when you look at something like MTHFR support, you're going to see like dozens of listings of repeated RSIDs for the same gene. And the reason for that is they've identified different locations, but they really haven't discerned if there's a clinical relevance to all of them. So some of the research is in that certain ones are more clinically relevant than others. And with FUT2, it's these three. But you will see, like on Stratagene, they only report one of these three. It's involved in the antigen formation, oligosaccharide. So those are just particular chemicals that do that. And it's associated with intestinal flora imbalance and Crohn's. So that says to me, I have an increased risk of Crohn's because I have this. It also produces, you know, it predisposes towards low concentration of bifidobacter, but it also involved in vitamin B12 levels. So what do I learn from this, that I have three homozygouses? I learned that I need to be really meticulous about my probiotic and prebiotic food intake, and I've got to be really careful about my vitamin B12 levels. And I also have some other genes, MTRR and MTR, that predispose me to vitamin B12. So B12 is something I need to be careful about. GIF, gastric intrinsic factor, is involved in the formation of intrinsic factor for B12 utilization. Intrinsic factor is produced by the parietal cells. Okay, so that you basically what I explained to you before, but I'm green for that. So I don't have that issue with intrinsic factor. But here is PEMT, which is the phosphoethanolamine methyltransferase. There's three of them. Two of mine are heterozygous, meaning I got one appropriate gene, one wild and one risk. From my parents, don't know which one, right? You can't tell which parent did the bad deed, right? But I know I have that here, so I have to be careful about my phospholipids. And so for me, like eating sunflower seeds or doing sunflower lecithin or any kind of lecithin for that matter can be really valuable for those membranes and really important for brain function as well as gut function. And then they have the SHMT, the serine hydroxymethyltransferase, which is involved in the purine synthesis via folate. Okay, so that's very much related to the methylation. We talked about the DNA repair. And when there's a mutation, it can lead to abnormal iron metabolism and predispose to GI pathogens. So if somebody has a really bad profile here, see, I have three normals and one heterozygous. That's not such a bad deal, whereas somebody that might have three homozygous and one heterozygous are going to be much more at risk there. And then this ATG16L1, autography-related 16-like-1, mumbo-jumbo, right? It's involved in the degradation of cells. Lysozyme is a product that can break down cells, and mutations in IBS and Crohn's.
right? So this is really an important one. Interferon regulatory factor. And again, I've got a lot of stuff going on gut-wise in my genes. So you might think that I would be more prone to gut stuff. And I am. I have a sensitive gut. I've had that sensitive gut since I was in my 20s, right? So it's involved in the antiviral cytokines and can be problematic in people with IBS. Now let's take a closer look at the FUT2 gene, fucosyl transferase. There are several variations, in fact, quite a number of them, and this is one that I have quite a number of those in as a homozygous. These are considered non-secretors. Those of us who have these variations in the FUT, these SNPs in the FUT2 gene, are considered non-secretors, meaning we don't secrete our ABO blood type into the surface or onto the surface of the cells and the body fluids like saliva, tears, and gut, and sweat as well. So 20% of Europeans and Africans are homozygous. So I'm among the lucky ones. My lineage is European. And it's involved in the formation of an immune complex that's known as the H antigen. This situation with this antigen does tend to make those of us with this variation have greater resistance to H. pylori, which is a good thing. And certain viruses like the norovirus, extremely resistant there. So those are good things. There's a lot of mixed feelings, though, with relationship to vitamin B12 and the bifidobacter, the concentration of probiotics in our gut. Some studies find that there's greater absorption of B12 because of this H antigen, and that same thing that gives us the greater resistance against H. pylori causes a better secretion of intrinsic factor, which helps with the absorption of B12. But other studies found that the B12 levels were lower, in some cases by about 16%, in the non-secretors. This may have to do with which variations of the gene. Like I said, there's quite a number of them, and I think it's just there's a lot of research, but nothing completely conclusive. Most of the study, I would say more than half of the studies I looked at, did say that people with the FUT2 have a greater blood concentration of B12 due to the improved intrinsic factor and absorption. But there were quite a number of studies. One has said as high as 30% lower in non-secretors. So I guess there's just more research to be done there. The FUT2 forms oligosaccharides, which are short chain sugars. Monosaccharides, which are one sugar. We have disaccharides, are two. We have polysaccharides, which are many. And oligo is a small number, like somewhere between 3 and 12. So they're short forms of sugar. Oligosaccharides do tend to feed the good bacteria in the gut, not the bad bacteria in the gut. So for many people, most people, in fact, oligosaccharides like inulin and things like that are actually helpful. And for some people, it feeds their bad guys and they need to avoid it. But in general, this FUT2 allows us to form oligosaccharides. So those of us who have the SNP, especially the homozygous SNP, form less oligosaccharides. Those oligosaccharides in turn become good food for the gut flora. And as a result, we have lower concentrations of bifidobacter as a non-secretor and an increased risk of Crohn's disease and inflammation in the gut. So it's a double-edged sword here, right? Higher levels of B12, maybe better resistance to certain viruses in H. pylori on the good side, but higher risk of Crohn's disease and inflammation in the gut on the other side, and bifido. So supplementation of bifidobacter, super important here. And, you know, probiotic type foods can be fortified with bifidobacter to produce more, or a separate supplement of bifidobacter, super important for protecting the gut in people who are non-secretors. This is when I looked at my raw data. If I had this kind of a chart, or I had a chart like this from MTHFR support, which lists everything, then I can look at that in comparison to here. But really, this looking at the raw data alone doesn't give me anything. So it looks like FUT2 is on the 19th chromosome, and there's a whole bunch of them, and they go way down. So the only ones that they've found to be clinically relevant are generally the ones that are reported in these nice little fancy interpretation reports. So I just gave you summaries. We mentioned most of these, not all of them though, on the pages with the GI, but I always like to do this. I like to sort things in different ways. That's how my brain remembers things. So when I was in school, I would learn, like say I was learning muscle metabolism, I'd write a chart that showed me the names of all the muscles, the actions, the origins, the insertions. Then I'd make another chart that had all the actions and which muscles were related. Then I'd write all the origins and write down the muscles related there. So it really helped me to reorganize. So when I was doing these charts, I thought, well, let's look at all the nutrient-related genes together. Well, BCM01 is related to vitamin A, and it has to do with the conversion of beta-carotene into vitamin A. Vitamin A is critical for mucous membranes, critical for the health and the function of the endothelium in the gut. Vitamin B6 is very important for a lot of functions related to the gut and to neurotransmitters. NBPF3 is a gene that's related there. B12, FUT2, folate and B2, MTHFR. Vitamin C, SLC23A1, and vitamin E, intergenic, increases vitamin E. So, there we go. So some of those intergenic ones are related. So vitamin D, I took vitamin D out separately because I feel like there's so many of these. I wanted you to have them all in one place because you're going to see this a lot. You're going to see this person and they get tested and they start going on 5,000 IU's of vitamin D. And 3 months later, it has only gone up a little bit. You're going, huh, that's weird. And then other people where you give that same amount of vitamin D and their levels go up tremendously in 3 months. Why? Well, it's related to a lot of these genes. And because vitamin D is so critical for the health of the gut, you really need to make sure that your clients all have good vitamin D levels. So VDR is the receptor. GCR, which is an RSID22, I guess I put the RSID in there, encodes an enzyme that transports D in the blood into the cells. Super important, right? So it's in the blood, but it doesn't get into the cells. It's not going to do any good. CYP24A1 in maintaining calcium homeostasis with the vitamin D. CYP27B1 encodes an enzyme that activates the vitamin D. DHCR7 is a switch that regulates the switch between cholesterol and vitamin D synthesis, because we know that vitamin D is synthesized from cholesterol. And then finally, GRCH38 is related to a binding protein, binding and carrying the vitamin D. So it's super important. Why is vitamin D so important? Well, SNPs that lead to low or normal vitamin D have an effect on the pancreas and the digestive lining. VDR FOK is associated with blood sugar issues and poor pancreatic activity, whereas VDR TAQ SNPs are combined with COM-T can lead to difficulty with methyl donors. So these are some things just to keep in mind as you're looking, because the VDR, when they have a VDR and a COM-T and an MAO, they have a tendency towards obsessive compulsive behavior. So there's a lot of things that are related and interrelated, and we know the gut is so related to everything else. So I wanted to tie some of the other aspects in. So let's look at eating related genes. These are kind of fun. The bitter taster, there's a couple of genes, TAS2R38, and there's various RSIDs related to bitter taster. Sweet taster, TAS1R3, related to RS, that long RSID. I'm not going to read it out loud. People who are salt sensitive, maybe related to GNB3, NOS3, ACE, and AGT. Gluten intolerance related to HLA-DQ2.5 and DQ8. Lactose intolerance, MC-M6. Alcohol intolerance, you know those people who drink alcohol and their body doesn't respond well? That's me. When I drink it, I crave more and it affects my gut big time. ALDH2, so I don't drink it at all. And alcohol metabolism is related to that phase 1 liver enzyme CYP2E1. So all of these related to nutrients, the digestive tract itself, and the eating-related behaviors are all important things to be considering in gut health. There's some that are related to fat metabolism. So APOE3-4 or 4-4 makes people very sensitive to saturated fats, especially the animal fats. The APOA2, either the C or T SNP, regulate the response to after meals to saturated fat. Remember, the C makes people store the fat and T lets them burn it. PPAR-G related to diabetes and the relationship between the gut and the absorption of sugars. And then APOPOQ is an adipose-specific gene that's related to fat metabolism. Whew, a lot here, right? a lot here. Here's the just the one pager, just to show you the example of what this looks like. This the symbol. Go to metabolichealing.com. It's an awesome report. I highly recommend that you look at it. So now that you know these genes, what are you going to do? Okay, so let's just start with the start. I would get the 23andMe testing done. Download the raw data. You'll download it into a text file, a TXT file on your computer, and it will then be used to be uploaded into these various places. So you upload it to Genetic Genie to get the methylation and detox, the MTHFR support, the metabolic healing, the Stratagene, and then Livewello, Prometheus, whatever ones you want to do. I highly recommend you at least do the first of them, the Genetic Genie, MTHFR support, metabolic healing, and Stratagene at least once. You can join the Stratagene Facebook support group once you've done one Stratagene, and they have a great Facebook support group with a lot of discussion about it. I can't keep up with it all, but I periodically go in there and study some. And then study with someone who's a few steps ahead. So, you know, stay on the INE Facebook page, talk to us, and get involved, and bring your case studies for those in the full NEPT program. So the complex interrelationships. This is not a this for that approach, and I really caution you to stay away from that. It's funny because a lot of people come from the traditional medical background, either as a practitioner or as a patient, and have the mentality of this for that. What do you take for this? Oh, if you have this gene, what supplements do you take? And that can't be further from the truth. We're looking at balance. When we're looking at being functional medicine practitioners or functional nutritionists, we are looking at balance. So there isn't a this for that. There's an identify the imbalances and help to correct them. These biochemical reactions are working together to produce an end result, an end effect, or a particular chemical product in the body. In the raw data, there are over 900,000 SNPs. That's a lot of SNPs. The Genetic Genie reports and the YASCO reports do about 30 of those. The MTHFR support and Livewello do about 300 of those. They actually analyze. So we're getting down from 900,000 SNPs all the way down to what's clinically relevant or found to be clinically relevant. Now, there may be a lot of those within that 900K that are clinically relevant. We just don't have the research to back it, so there aren't a lot of these reports that show it. That doesn't mean that having the rest of those 900K in your report isn't going to come in handy someday. Because remember, doing your genetics is a one-time lab. Right? It's not like testing your blood or looking at your stool or doing any of those other things that change over time. Those are functional tests. This is static. So 20 years from now, if we figure out what some of those other genes are, you'll have your raw data to be able to look at for that. Stratagene and metabolic healing together, they do several dozen. I hesitate to put an exact number because they're constantly adding new things to their reports. But you're seeing that really the most clinically relevant is under 100 of these 900,000 of them. We need to take a holistic perspective. A small percentage of the genes we currently know about have the one-to-one cause effect, the this for that effect. Cystic fibrosis is one of them. Most of them are complex interconnectedness, and we can't just say, oh, you have this gene and you're going to give this supplement. For example, in someone who has methylation issues, they have, you know, homozygous MTHFR C677T, they have some of the other B12 ones, and they're having a problem with methylation. If you go ahead and load that person with methyl supplements like methyl B12 and methyl folate, that person has also a COMT homozygous catecholamine O-methyltransferase, remember, relates to the dopamine, serotonin, and those neurotransmitters. Then what happens is those, because of the backup of the COMT, those methyl groups can't be fully utilized. We get a buildup of the excitatory neurotransmitters. And so if you happen to give somebody, or somebody comes into your office and says to you, you know, I went to the doctor and they tested me for this MTHFR thing and they gave me this supplement and it was 5,000 milligrams of methyl folate and I felt so agitated and almost like homicidal, that person needs to stop that and go very slowly. So whenever I'm giving people methylated B vitamins, I move slowly. Even if they don't have that COMT, I still move slowly. I'll move less slowly if they don't have it, but if they do, I'm moving very slowly to help them build up the tolerance and start to utilize them so they don't get what's called methyl trapping and a buildup of methyl groups. But looking at this for that approach with genes, looking at one gene and saying, thinking you know that person and know what to do with that person is like the story of the blind men and the elephant. Each of those blind men is at a different spot on the elephant and they're asked, what is this? So the one that has the tail is saying, oh, it's a rope. The one that has the horn is saying, it's a spear. The one that has the trunk is saying, oh, it's a snake. The one that has the leg is saying, it's a tree. The one that has the ear says, it's a fan. The one that's touching the body says, it's a wall. Everybody has a different way of seeing it, quote unquote, because they're blind. They don't see the whole picture. They don't see the whole elephant. They're just looking at their specific spot because they're feeling. Same thing if you pick up and somebody goes and does an MTHFR with their doctor and they come back and say, oh, and the doctor put me on all these supplements because of my MTHFR. It may do them some good, not to say that it won't, but it's missing the big picture. And the big picture also is related to what else? Before you address the individual SNPs, you need to be looking at the foundational diet and lifestyle. You can't just go in on the SNPs and say, oh, let's give this person these supplements, and they're still eating crap, and they're stressing out, and they're not sleeping. So I have what I call the seven pillars of health, the low stress, strong values and vision, sleep, good sleep, healthy diet, exercise, clean environment, and fun. And if any of those are out of balance and you start messing with their gene manipulation, then you're not going to get very far. You're going to hit a wall. Remove all folic acid. Folic acid is a synthetic form of folate, and it can block the receptors for the true methylated folate, and it can have an impact on the methylation pathways, brain health, gut health. Doing a gut healing and pathogen removal. You know how to do that now. This is really important before we start addressing the SNPs. Yes, it's good to know the SNPs so you can maybe modify that gut healing and pathogen removal program, but you're not going to skip that just because you're going to address the SNPs directly. Balance blood sugar, address mitochondrial dysfunction, test their homocysteine levels and see where they're at. Offer B vitamin support, adrenal support, adaptogens, and thyroid support. You've got to be supporting the entire system before you start doing the approach of SNPs. And I will give you an example. Dr. Ben Lynch, he's got a great site called mthfr.net. He created the strategy and report. And he says over and over in the strategy and Facebook group, over and over, people want to know, well, what supplements should I take? He says, look, I run a supplement company. It would be very easy for me to make a report that says, here's the SNPs, here's your supplement protocol. I've seen those labs. I've seen those reports. I did one on me and it gave me 4 pages of supplements I should be taking. It's ludicrous. It's not in the best integrity for people to do that. So this is what Dr. Lynch says. He's like, here's the list of 20 things you should be doing before you start to address your SNPs head on. And I agree with him wholeheartedly. So, you know, look to the genes, yes, but what about the environment, right? Something's not right. Our air is clean. Our water is pure. We get plenty of exercise. Everything we eat is organic and free range, yet nobody lives past 30. What do you think's going on there? Maybe tigers and lions, right? Okay, so we can't just blame the genes. We've got to look at the environment, right? If we were there to say, maybe we have some gene malfunctions. No, it has to do with the tigers. What in the environment is triggering the symptoms before you start to look further? So in terms of digestion, we looked at this before. It's at the core, at the base of balancing the rest of the organ and gland systems. We've looked at this throughout our digestion program. The HCL challenge to see how well the stomach's producing, transit time, how well is stuff moving through, stool testing, blood tests, you know, bun, protein, albumin, globulin. These are all important tests that you can do to test the status of the digestion. What I've given you here is another tool, but you really can't just go for the gene testing and skip the rest of it. It's super important. So you remember in our trackers, we have our protocol trackers. You do the assessments. You find out where people are at. You help them follow a protocol. You track them. This is all laid out for you in the whole rest of our Digestion Mastery program. And the chart, this is explained in detail in the implementation module. So you can go back and review that. It's also explained in various parts of the assessments pieces. You can't skip this stuff, guys. You can't just jump and say, oh, this person has an FUT. Let's just give them a probiotic. But what else is going on? We really need to be looking at the big picture, at a holistic approach. We also have stool testing, right? What kind of organisms? This can be used well in conjunction with the gene testing to see if that person who has the Bifidobacter problem, perhaps with the FUT2, is it expressing? Let's look at it. Well, this person clearly is either on a lot of bifidus or they don't have the FUT gene because their Bifidobacter is great. But they also have a lot of other stuff that's out of balance, some commensal organisms that are way out of balance. And that's just another, you know, page that you can look at the digestive function, and you can do this through stool testing. It's super important that you keep the big picture in mind, that you use the genetic testing for what it is, another tool in your toolbox. So some of the blood test reminders of that are suggested. This is the easiest test to do. If they don't have regular insurance, they can go to directlabs.com or any of a number of direct access labs. Test protein, globulin, bun, phosphorus, creatinine, iron, calcium, sodium, uric acid, alkaline phosphatase, GGT, hematocrit, white blood cells, neutrophils, monocytes, lymphocytes, and eosinophils. And if this all seems like gobbledygook to you, it's in our assessments piece, and it goes into much more detail in the full NEPT program. So thank you for your attention here. Thank you for being here and for your interest in taking care of your clients in a really profound way. This science is very intricate. This science is very elaborate. This is something you're not going to learn overnight. You're going to want to listen to this over and over, study the pages, print them out, and look at a lot of labs. That's the way that you get good at this. It's not by reading and studying it and then going out and feeling like you're an expert. No, you look at them, you look at them, you look at them. And I would start with yourself and start with your family members, and you'll start to get used to this so that you feel confident working in this realm with your clients. So thank you.